Weekends are better when you spend it with us. Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk TNT.
Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining me today for Weekends with Jason Olborn here on TNT Radio. Well, I can assure you that here, where I'm broadcasting from in Australia, the sun is shining, the lawnmowers are out, the mini bikes are revving, and it seems that they're all circling this little studio where I'm operating from. And if you hear some noise in the background, that is Australia being Australia, which in many ways, what does that even mean anymore? One thing's for sure is that the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, is on the ropes and he's throwing some haymakers wherever he can because he wants to censor what you and I and the rest of the world can see. And it's not going down too well because Elon Musk has grown a pair and he's saying absolutely not. And the man at the centre of it all, Bishop Mari Emanuel, the man who was stabbed by the 16-year-old boy, well, he's saying don't censor that video either. It should be out there. And according to The Australian, the 16-year-old boy was charged with terrorism offence after the alleged stabbing of Bishop Emanuel. Well, he idolises slain al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. This is according to The Australian, using a photograph of the terrorist as his profile picture. In what appears to be a major security breach, the names, addresses and other personal details of five teams charged as part of Wednesday terrorism raids are being shared across WhatsApp groups, a blunder that Islamic leaders say has led to an anti-Muslim retaliation attack on one of the youths. Social media accounts associated with the 16-year-old boy's mobile number, uncovered by The Australian newspaper, used bin Laden and other Islamic State jihadi fighters as their profile pictures, including a smiling portrait of the 9/11 mastermind on his WhatsApp. And on his Telegram account, he uses a picture of two jihadi fighters decked in all black as a cover photo, while another depicts Islamic State fighters holding rifles and brandishing the terror group's distinctive black flag in Syria. How about that? And if that's not enough, Harvey Weinstein finds out that his original conviction has been overturned and he's set for a retrial. He doesn't get out of prison on that. And also he did get a separate conviction after this particular case where he's serving a further 16 years out of LA. So it looks like Harvey Weinstein, 72, isn't going anywhere particularly fast. But his lawyers, well, they're going to make a fortune providing him potentially false hope. How about that story? And Tucker Carlson, how about this, is coming to Australia in a little over about 6 weeks' time, courtesy of, well, former political member of parliament, Clive Palmer, millionaire mining magnate, but now it seems a promoter on these terrific events. The one that he had Peter McCullough out a year and a bit ago was a huge success, a sellout. And one wonders if Tucker Carlson will be even allowed into Australia, given that Donald Trump Jr. was not. Well, some political shenanigans prevented his visa coming in time, which for anyone else would have been allocated as such. But in Don Jr.'s case, he wasn't able to come out and has tried to come back to further times, and each time that's also been postponed. Now, Tucker Carlson, some were saying, may even be Donald Trump's pick as his running mate as vice president. So wouldn't it be interesting if the Australian government decides to play funny, well, silly buggers again with Tucker Carlson and do something there? So it remains to be seen if he's coming. And of course, Tucker Carlson, if he wasn't going to be VP, how about this? Imagine if Tucker Carlson was introduced in 6 months' time as Donald Trump's future press secretary or communications director. Wouldn't you want to know then what the government was doing and getting a real newsman or woman in that place to be able to deliver such updates? Of course, it's all just speculation at this stage, but interesting nonetheless when you see who aligns with who in the world, as we like to say here on this show, as we face the impending fall of Rome. And we report on what's happening along the way. And of course, what happens afterwards when, if the decks are cleaned? And as Julian Assange says, 70 to 90% of Washington, D.C. is taken out if the corruption is exposed. Well, what kind of world do we want? And what kind of world do we look for to create for ourselves? Do we allow the people that have been so corrupt to push us into this globalist pathway of losing our freedoms and digital ID telling us what we have to do and be surveilled in our lives? Is that the world that we really want? And if not, what world do we want? So we'll always explore that. Now, Got a great lineup of guests for you today, and I'm going to introduce you to my first guest in just a moment. But coming up in the next hour, for the first time, Professor James Allen. Well, he's a professor at University of Queensland. He's a Canadian by birth, and he'll be here to talk about a series of stories that he's written in The Spectator, some of which concern Canada, others which concern us here in Australia, including whether or not in the West we are getting happier or not compared to the rest of the world. James is right on top of that. Also going to have independent journalist Johnny H. calling in from Russia, giving us an update on his travels. He also came out with a documentary recently, very successful. Be great to catch up with Johnny again. And Robbie Barwick for the first time on this show, but you have seen him before on TNT. Well, he's part of the Citizens Party, and he is taking the bull by its horns when it comes to the government and the banking inquiry. Will we become a cashless society? Will cash actually suffer from a surcharge? That's what people are talking about now. And even last week, it was suggested by the Barefoot Investor, a very famous Australian who's written some very successful books, explaining why he thinks that you might have to pay to use cash, because lugging those coins around no longer a cost of doing business. It's just a cost in the eyes of business. Just shows you that supply and demand in real business is a very, very odd way of looking at things these days. But this is the world where the economic rationalists insist on knowing what's going on. And all of that sets us up beautifully, because my first guest this hour is the return of Dr. Josiah Baker. Let me tell you about him, because his book that he came on to talk about last time, The Optimist, remains the best book I've read probably in 10 years, if not longer. The best self-help book. He'll show you that in a sec when we bring him on. The best self-help book you will ever read in terms of explaining and showing you with the magic in real time how you can change your life for the best. And that's the most exciting thing here. It's not only told as a work of fiction, but also as a workbook. And you'll see the only time ever where you get a real success story in real time that covers all the bases to change your life. However, Josiah Baker, as I said, is an assistant professor of financial economics at the Methodist University and an adjunct associate professor of economics and geography at George Mason Uni. He's the author of several books on economics, politics, and religion, so all of the topics you're not supposed to talk about. And then a couple of years back, Josiah teamed up with Ulf Sandstrom and together turned the tables on the problems of the day, focused on solutions. As I just mentioned, Josiah Baker, welcome back to Weekends and TNT.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, look, it's great to see you and have you on the show again. And if you don't mind, before we get started, I noticed in the preview there you had the book of The Optimist. If you don't mind just putting it up sort of in front of you here on the split, just to give people an idea, we are going to talk about that incredible book a bit later on. There's something about it, Josiah, that when you start reading it, like any book, you sort of give yourself a couple of pages to get in. Can you find rhythm, et cetera? But this is a book, when you're five or six pages in, you can't put it down. I think I told you last time, I knocked it over in a bit over a day. I just simply said to my wife, that's it. I can't stop reading this book. I want to get to the end and find out what happens. It's that good. But it's also a constructive workbook just the same, because this is the point, isn't it? It's not just about telling you a story that's magic. It's about putting it into play. And that's why it's The Optimist. It's changing everyone's life by the way we view the world we live in.
Absolutely. It's an interactive book. It's a book that gets you to reflect. It's a book to point out the important facets of life and to help you better prioritize what's important to you. And I think a lot of times people get caught up with things that aren't important, or they tend to forget what really gives them meaning and purpose in life. And yeah, so this book, The Optimist, it's a brief book, but it has an awful lot in it in terms of how it can change your life. And I've spent many, many years, in fact, the two of us, just getting it into English and making English simple was quite a task. It's changed a lot of people's lives, and I'm thrilled that people in Australia will get a chance to look at it as well.
And they certainly can. There's a couple of different ways that you can pick up the book to look. If you're going to look up The Optimist, just type in Josiah Baker. You'll probably find it on Amazon or at Trinday Publishing. And it is a real gift for someone, including yourself. It's under 200 pages. As I said, when you get into it, you'll read it probably the quickest you could read any book, because you're just so much into it. But the other thing is, it's a bit like servicing your car, Josiah, in the sense that a bit of maintenance, like it's one thing to read it and realize that this has the capacity to change your life, but of course life gets in the way, and unless you set up a commitment to go about doing it, you might find that 6 months goes past and you realize, well, I haven't actually done that. But the point being, like your car, like you pay money to have it maintained, it's the same for our own spiritual selves to work out what we really want. And just as an example, in the United States, tax time's around about the 1st of April. In Australia, it's the 1st of July. And of course, when we think of the end of year and Christmas, they're just milestone dates in the calendar year where we might say, you know what, I haven't really enjoyed what I've done in the past year. My tax return wasn't as good as I wanted. I perhaps didn't earn enough money. I didn't go on that holiday that I'd planned. They're all reasons why you didn't. But now you can say, well, hang on a second. Maybe this is the moment where I reward myself, go and drop $10, $15, or $20 on the book, whatever it costs in your part of the world, and say, you know what, I am going to give this a go. It's something different. So there's just a suggestion for everyone. And I'm quite grateful that you're here today, Josiah, because right now we're going to switch gears, because over there in the US, there's something called an election coming up, and it's got a lot of people really struggling with what's going on. So in the first instance, before we get on to the subject that we're going to talk about today, your other book, which I'll get you to introduce in a moment, can you just give me a feeling of what it's like on the ground in an election year? Are people starting to talk about it? Has the mood changed in the United States? Is there an air of change in the air at the moment, a feeling of change?
There certainly is an air of change on the Democratic side, in the sense that a lot of people feel that Biden is too old and that Biden is not really somebody that people can imagine running the country for another 4 years. And Kamala Harris has the lowest popularity ratings, I think, of any vice president since we started measuring them. So nobody seriously looks at her as an alternative. And so there's some discussion that during the Democratic National Convention in August, that maybe there would be some replacement candidate, some speculation that the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, might be somebody that could step up. The Democratic Party operates a little differently than the Republican Party, in that the mechanics make it to where it's easier to replace a candidate during the national convention than it is with the Republicans. And on the Republican side, which is pretty obvious, Trump really didn't have any contenders. The question has been, of course, can he beat Biden? And or who is he going to end up beating if or going up against? And at the same time, people wonder what will happen. What would a second Trump term mean? And so, yeah, there's a lot of anxiety, anticipation. We have economic problems. We have persistent high inflation. We have millions of young men in particular that are not working and are not counted as unemployed. We have a lot of unaffordable housing issues in most of the major metropolitan areas. We have crime spikes. Looks a lot like it did in many ways, like in the 1970s after the oil crisis and here in the United States. And so people are looking for some kind of optimism. They're looking for some kind of positive change. And we're not really getting much out of the White House. And at the same time, people really aren't sure what to expect. Is Trump really going to go up against President Biden? We just have to wait, because there's just, they could change it till August. But yeah, I think some people also really thought inflation was beat. They thought interest rates would go down. They're not going down. And so there's now talk of something called stagflation, which is where you have a stagnant economy and increasing prices. And nobody likes that. And I can safely say that the vast majority of Americans right now are very unhappy with the economic situation. And that usually means that people would be open to change. But here we're going to have a rematch, possibly the same two candidates. And I can't recall a time, you would have to go back to the beginning of the United States, where we actually had a rematch of the same two candidates, two elections in a row. It just has not happened in modern times.
It is an extraordinary revelation, but of course it's an extraordinary time. And look, Tucker Carlson is still talking about the 2020 election at the same time that we're seeing that the alternate electors case that's popped up now in Arizona and Michigan. They're going after people who were involved with questioning the results of the election yet again. They've named Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani as unindicted co-conspirators. It seems that the language won't stop. The establishment, which is technically controlled by the Democrats, is doing whatever it possibly can to not have Donald Trump re-elected. It seems that they will do absolutely anything at this stage. So they are running scared, and that suggests to people who are observant to what's going on that this time, after all of the warfare that's happening, Trump is going to take no prisoners this time, because he will want to get square is one way of looking at it. But the other way is more so the fact that if you're going to play the games that you're going to play, well, let's call you out for your dirty crimes. And there is just so many that we could talk about, such as obviously the origins of COVID would have to be the biggest. The fact that no one around the world is even interested in getting to the bottom of it was just a mistake, an innocent mistake. And meanwhile, all the powers that be made a fortune. And I find that a very, very disturbing situation. Now, just what we might do, Josiah, is quickly take a break. And when we come back, I will get into this election year and looking at details that many haven't talked about, one of which is your new book, your book called Religion, Politics and Polarization, How Religio-Political Conflict is Changing Congress and American Democracy. There it is. We're going to talk about that after the break. But before we do, did you know that there are many ways that you can watch or listen to TNT? Why not stream us direct from our website on your desktop, tablet, or mobile device, or download our app from the App Store? We even stream live on X, YouTube, Rumble, and Odyssey. We've got you covered on today's News Talk, TNT.
TNT's Kate Shimarani.
You have to be very, very careful with pregnant women when giving them drugs, or women that are breastfeeding, because those drugs will be carried in the breast milk. So why are biological men being given drugs to produce milk, breast milk, that's being fed to the babies in the premature baby unit, SCABU? And they've actually said it's as good as women's milk. I don't see how that is possible, because those drugs that will stimulate the pituitary and everything else that this man is taking are going to be in that breast milk. What could possibly go wrong?
Kate Shimarani on today's News Talk, TNT.
In a democracy, the majority vote rules. But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
The human mind is like a computer. No matter how efficient it may be, its reliability is only as great as the information fed into it.
That's a campaign promise.
Tell us the truth. Tell us the truth.
We mandate that the truth be told.
You're hearing it.
TNT.
And welcome back to Weekends. My guest this hour, Dr. Josiah Baker, all the way from North Carolina, discussing his book about religion and politics. Josiah, what made you go down this pathway and do the deep dive research to start working out with the data how this is influencing religion and politics? I mean, these are the two dirty words you're not supposed to talk about either, and you've gone the other way and talk about both.
Well, the origins of this study were rather unique in the sense that I was approached by somebody who worked for Cardinal Wuerl in Washington, D.C. So it was the Catholic Church that actually initially, they were interested in looking into this great political divide among American Catholics. I'm not familiar with the Catholic population of Australia, but the Catholic population in the United States was traditionally Democrat. And as you may recall, John Kennedy was the first Catholic president, and he was a Democrat. But what had happened since Roe v. Wade and other legislation, Roe v. Wade legalized abortion at the federal level through the Supreme Court, the Catholic Church became increasingly divided. And so the Cardinal, along with several people at Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., and others had contacted me In part because they wanted somebody, ironically, who was not Catholic to look into this. So, and I am not. And so what we had is we had teams of 4, 5, 6, 7 research assistants manually going through congressional votes from 1959 all the way up to 2010. And then we later added more years. And that took a very, very long time. Nobody had ever done this. Of all the political scientists and all the think tanks in DC, nobody had gone through an exhaustive manual study like this, where we matched religious affiliation with party membership on key votes relating to welfare spending, defense spending, tax cuts, and abortion. And we did others, but in the book, those were the four that got into this book. And so, but the root of it was, at the time, we had the Speaker of the House was Nancy Pelosi, who's a well-known Democrat, and also a Catholic. And she again became the Speaker. But then we had John Boehner, the next Speaker, who was also Catholic, but he's a Republican out of Ohio. And politically, the two were quite far apart. So we were trying to figure out how religion, how different religious affiliation influenced voting, members of Congress, and how also to explain why you have people who claim they're Catholic but have polar opposite political beliefs. How can they reconcile that? And we got to the bottom of it. We interviewed a lot of people in Congress, spent a lot of time at Capitol Hill. It was pretty easy because we were only a few, 7 or 8 kilometers from Capitol Hill, so we could easily go down there. And, you know, so in the end, we ended up producing this book and quite a number of other studies, and we found out some very, very interesting findings that were pretty conclusive.
So what were you able to conclude, therefore, in this analysis? This is really interesting, isn't it? Because to have a Catholic speaker from the Republicans, a Catholic speaker from the Democrats, and there is no way, I mean, it's perhaps one might argue that this is what the uni party really is, but we're not talking about that, because when you talk about specific issues, one party is pro-welfare, one party is against welfare, one party is seemingly pro for abortion, one party is against abortion. So you would think from the outset it would be unlikely to have a Republican Catholic, as it were. But today, when you consider marriage equality, for example, you would have to think that that would make more conservative Catholics. This is it's a fascinating topic. So what does the data reveal in terms of numbers?
Well, in terms of numbers, we have increasing numbers of Republican Catholics, just as an overall population and within the members of Congress. And in fact, going back from 1959, there was a huge jump in the number of Republicans that declare to be Catholic. And just to point things out, we determine someone's a religious affiliation based on what's called the congressional record. It's the official publication of Congress, where they declare certain things like their birthday and who they're married to and their children. And they almost always have a religious affiliation. This is really important in America because churches historically, as we did a lot of fundraising. But when we look at the data, one thing that really, really pointed out was that among Republican Catholics, they were most likely to support welfare spending out of any Republican group that we had. And for defense spending, we did find some commonalities, and that among Democrats for defense spending, they were Catholic Democrats were the least likely to support defense spending out of any Democrats. And out of any Republicans, the least likely to support defense spending were Republican Catholics. So there was some unity there in terms of going along with the teachings of Catholicism. The real difference with welfare has to do with methodology. So I had the opportunity to talk to a lot of people who work for both of the speakers of the House and interact with the speakers of the House in different ways. And some of my colleagues knew them very well. And to the best of my knowledge, I believe that Pelosi believes at least back then, she believed that she was a Catholic and believed in her faith, and she thought she was a good Catholic. And Boehner felt the same way. They both strongly perceived themselves as following church teachings, but the methodology is where it really is the difference. Republican Catholics believe that it should be done, say, helping the poor should be done through charitable acts, through private means. And the Catholic Church has a huge network of charities, for example. Democrat Catholics believe that the state should be used to carry out welfare. So there's more of an incorporation of church and state in terms of mechanizations from the Democratic Catholic point of view. So there's a methodology that they agree that the poor should be helped. They just disagree in how they want to go about doing it.
Isn't that interesting, Josiah, that when it comes to welfare, which obviously this mm-hmm. is the church's main business, if you will, I mean, charity, mm-hmm. but Democrats mm-hmm. saying, no, no, it should be the state doing it, whereas Republicans saying, no, no, it should be the church doing that. Now, this is an interesting part, isn't it? Because when you look at on the left, you've got Democrats wanting to mix church and state, which is, of course, the opposite of what the Constitution wants, which is a separation of church and state. How would they rationalize that?
They don't, because they see the state as a tool, and somehow they don't see them incorporating the religion into the state. They don't see it as a blending. They see it as we're going to use the state. And so there is an element of inconsistency there, I would say, if you're really looking for. And just as a reminder for your audience, the United States Constitution created a separation of church and state because they didn't want the state church that we had in England that was led by the monarch. We wanted, it wasn't that we didn't want churches, we didn't want a church to be run by the government, because the founders of the United States were against that kind of, they saw that as being oppressive. So, but they're not the only ones. Jewish Democrats, among all Democrats, were most strongly supportive of welfare spending and they also saw the state as a mechanism to further charitable causes. So, and to be clear, what we did is we ended up breaking religious groups into four different overall categories. We had Jews, Catholics, we broke Protestants into two areas. We have what are called the mainline Protestants. These are Protestant groups that were around before about 1800, 1810. And then in the United States, we had a period called the Great Awakening in 1820s to 1830s, 40s, where we had a lot of newer Protestant groups pop up. So some examples of the mainline older Protestant groups would be your Presbyterians, Lutherans, Episcopalians or Anglican, the Old Baptist Order, Quakers, and what's left of the Puritans today, which is called the Congregationalists. There's a couple others, but the newer Protestant groups, which we called conservative Protestants in the study, that's where you have the Southern Baptists, the Pentecostals, the Assemblies of God, the Mormons. We included Jehovah's Witnesses, but I couldn't find it. I don't remember any of them being in Congress, for example, but we did include basically the new Seventh-day Adventists was another group, the newer ones. And of course, the conservative Protestants, the conservative Protestant Republicans were the most against welfare, as welfare spending for the state. They strongly, strongly believed that welfare should be done by charitable and missionary acts. That was not a surprise. But we had other surprises in the data. Along each of these four topics. But welfare was definitely and continues to be a problem. If we look at our budget deficit, right now the U.S. government owes about $34 trillion total, and we're burning anywhere between $1 trillion to $2 trillion of additional debt every year. And Rand Paul, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, pointed this out, even if we got rid of all military spending, we still would have a deficit every year, because a huge part of it is the cost of our government for healthcare, because healthcare is very, very expensive here. I always point this out. We are much more expensive than any other country. It's just the way we do things. And also for our social security system and other entitlement programs. So in essence, the welfare spending is bankrupting the United States. Again, without military spending, we're still going bankrupt eventually, sooner or later. And that's a problem.
Of course, it's an absolutely massive problem, isn't it? And it's a problem facing countries all around the world. We've seen now in the UK, I'll be talking to Professor James Allen in the next hour. He's covered this, where a situation there that the Prime Minister of the UK is boasting about economic growth below 0.5%. And when you then look into the expansion of the public sector in terms of jobs, and he specifically hones in on that and relates it back to the amount of those jobs that are now work from home jobs. So he's questioning productivity. And at the same time, illegal immigrants in that country costing the country £50,000 each per annum, and I'm going to clarify that point with him, is an enormous amount of money that's just out of thin air. And of course, they too are running on a budget deficit. So they're literally borrowing money to pay people who shouldn't be there to stay. And you just wonder about the twist in the logic in this particular situation. And so what are they arguing, that they're coming from a place with less means than us, so we will borrow to pay? And then you wonder, what does a country actually represent if it doesn't represent its own people? That's a very different part of the discussion. But our discussion today, Josiah, talking about these different religious groups, were you able to determine, now this is referring to people elected to Congress and what their religious affiliations are. Is there more of a religious Christian basis, let's say, on the Democrats or the Republicans? Is it evenly dispersed in terms of what people actually talk about? How is that divided up?
Very good question. And this is probably one of the more controversial points of the book. And controversial in that the argument that we make is that the left is just as religious as the right. Their religiosity is just manifested in a very different way. And it's done so in that the left tradition, they seem to have co-opted the government as really the new religion. So we think about a state religion or a state church, the government and the government mechanisms are actually where they look for truth and justice, and their faith in the government is very strong, and they have a moralistic view on government. And so government, they is the answer for a lot of the leftist religiosity. And with the right, what we're seeing, of course, is we're seeing greater participation in the conservative Protestant groups. The mainline Protestants are the ones that are really disappearing. So, and we have that in the book. If we go back to 1959, in 1959, we had President Eisenhower, probably the least controversial president we had in the 20th century. Everybody liked Ike, and the country was very united in the 1950s, and America in the 1950s is very popular around the world as a time of prosperity and the golden era. Well, at that time, the vast majority members of Congress strongly were religiously affiliated with mainline Protestant groups. You're very middle of the road, Protestant, old Protestant groups. And there wasn't this this great religious fervor in a sense among the leadership in Congress. That changed in the 1970s with people like Jerry Falwell on the religious right. And there was an energized group of Christians that were very much against what they saw from the hippie counterculture coming up in the 60s and the abandonment of traditions. And so what we've seen is this great divide that has become greater and greater. And it's extremely pronounced in the United States. You asked me earlier in this interview about what the temperament is in America. I will tell you right now, Jason, there are two Americas. There's the big city America, like Detroit, Chicago, LA, and then you have the suburbs and the exurbs and the rural parts of America, which couldn't be any different. Even in states like California, You have huge tracts of areas in California that are loaded with people that have very, very different opinions than people in San Francisco and Los Angeles. I was just in California a few weeks ago in the San Francisco area, for example, and it is a, you know, you go to 30 miles to the east, you're in a different political world. And we see that in other parts of the country. So we had this great divide in the 19th century. We had a civil war over that, but that was between, say, North and South. What makes this really messy is it's metro areas versus non-metro areas. And you see that spelled out with the religiosity in those areas as well.
Yeah, look, it's a very interesting analysis that you brought to us. And of course, also identifying the difference in the US in the 50s post-war baby boom era, a chicken in every pot as the legacy of FDR moving into Eisenhower, looking forward and looking up, if you will, and then moving into the 60s and the hippiedom. But of course, that takes on the whole era of, well, the short era of JFK. And then we arrive at the 70s and the arrival of Jerry Falwell, which is fascinating because it comes on the back of the Nixon era, then I suppose you might call it the Nixon embarrassment, and then of course Jimmy Carter's presidency that reminds me in many ways of what we're seeing at the moment, more or less, in terms of this divide, perhaps the oil crisis era. I want to examine that, but we are going to have to take a break, and it's just a fascinating a way that we're seeing how history appears to be repeating itself, but we're now looking through the lens of how the religious divide across Democrats and Republicans. You don't want to go anywhere. This is the only place I reckon you can get anywhere in the world analysis that will make you go, yes, now I understand exactly what's going on, and it will help you frame how you see the entire world. You only get that on TNT, and you only get that here on Weekends with me, Jason Olborn. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this. You're watching TNT.
We come from a long line of farmers, and there's a sense of pride with being part of these multi-generational businesses. But there's also a significant amount of pressure. My senior year of high school, my dad made the decision this world no longer needed him in it. I don't know if he was overwhelmed by the bills and checks that weren't going to be coming in because of the strawberries dying off, but it breaks my heart that my dad made a permanent decision for a temporary issue. Don't feel like you have to go through it alone.
Farmers have to take care of their physical and their mental health, because what's a farm without a farmer?
In the mornings, that's my time. Watching the sun come up, I can have a cup of coffee and exercise if I want to. It helps me start the day with a sense of gratitude.
Yay!
Every day is a new opportunity. Don't forget to check in on yourself. Love your mind.
One scorching heat wave will leave me powerless to cool my insulin.
When the storm rolls in, my time to find a pet-friendly evacuation center will have run out.
I'm relying on luck, but who knows if it'll be on my side.
When it comes to disasters and emergencies, it's not a matter of if, but when. Take control. 1. Assess your needs. 2. Make a plan. 3. Engage your support network. Let's prepare so we all have a better story to tell.
The intersection of information and conversation. Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to Weekends. My guest this hour, Dr. Josiah Baker, and we are discussing his work in his book about religion and politics. And it's fascinating how history seems to be repeating itself. Now, Jerry Falwell arrived somewhere in the late 70s, and this is in the era leading up to Ronald Reagan taking on Jimmy Carter in, I suppose you could call it a political massacre. When Reagan arrived, it was the end of Carter's political career. He just wiped him out and then repeated it again in 84, even a bigger victory against Walter Mondale. Now, this is an interesting twist because for so far, we've looked primarily at the analysis of Catholicism amongst Democrats and Republicans. Both Democrats and Republicans have had a Catholic speaker. But Falwell's arrival seems to rejuvenate the right. Does this help Reagan, or does Reagan help Falwell? How does this all come together?
It's a fascinating story, because a lot of people don't realize that prior to being president, Reagan was the governor of California. And in his career before, he was a Hollywood movie star in the 1940s. And so Reagan, as a governor, was very much a moderate. He was not somebody you would think that would align himself with born-again Christians or the Christian right. In that regard, he's kind of similar to Trump, not having that kind of background. It was Reagan that actually, California was the first state that legalized abortion. Happened under Reagan in 1969. California also legalized what is called no-fault divorce around that same time, first state. Both of these are very left of center political issues or political initiatives. So Reagan, when he ran for president in 1976, things started to change. And there were certain key people in Reagan's campaign that approached him, and he realized that that there was a group of people out there that were increasingly marginalized by the politics of Jimmy Carter in the 1970s. And Reagan, depending on who you talk to, also became more conservative, going from more of a moderate Republican to more of a conservative Republican. And by the time he ran in 1980, George Herbert Walker Bush, sometimes we call him Bush Sr., was the more moderate Republican in the primaries, and he lost to Reagan, and then Reagan brought him on as his vice president. But 1980 was really the change in that election. When he beat Carter, an alliance was made between Falwell and others with this understanding that Reagan was going to champion what he called the Judeo-Christian ethics. And he was possibly the last president we've had that used that term. But Reagan had this grandfatherly style about him when he would address people on radio and television, particularly television. And of course, being the actor that he was, he could say a lot of things that other people couldn't say, and it was came across very smooth and very persuasive. And so he could say things like, God bless America, and it would really, really work, whereas other people couldn't get away with that. The irony here, Jason, is that Jimmy Carter, by all accounts, was a born-again Christian, very devout Christian, very, we'd call maybe left-of-center Christian, but here he loses to a guy who was not, but recently had co-opted the Christian right. And it all had to do with the policies that Reagan was going to promise versus the policies that happened during the Carter administration, and a lot of economic misery in the late 70s. And a lot of Americans have forgotten just how bad our economy was in the 70s. People really were looking for a new voice, a new change. And I remember the live televised debate, the last one that Carter and Reagan made. And Carter was saying something, and Reagan looked over at Carter and he said, there he goes again. And at that moment, you just knew that Carter lost the election. And the timing of it, Reagan's had that, of course. People were ready for a change. They were ready for somebody different. And Reagan had that smile, he had that approach, and a lot of Christians who previously had voted Democrat had voted for Carter over Ford in the 76 election. They decided to give Reagan a try. And then we had 8 years of Reagan.
We certainly did, but the magnitude of his victory, I can't recall anything the size of Reagan's wins in 79 and in 83. I mean, pretty sure against Mondale, he won all but one or two states. I mean,
you're absolutely right. He narrowly lost Minnesota, and he didn't get the District of Columbia, but no Republican ever has. So,
extraordinary. And of course, to be a Republican governor of California in today's terms, people would think that is a statistical impossibility. But to be that persuasive and to get, if you're winning 48 or 49 states, you are getting to a stage where you're looking at somebody who's united religious Democrats, religious Republicans, if you will, to say, well, hang on a second, this is a big difference. But you make the point that there's Jimmy Carter, a devout Christian, but can't seem to make the connection or even the separation. The idea that Reagan, with the separation of church and state and the separation, the way that he's done it, is perhaps an arm's length approach that appealed to people on both sides. Yes, I can respect, he says, Judeo-Christian morals or ethics, but at the same time, it's not my business. And he was a master at doing that, wasn't he? When criticized, when someone said that his opponent looked young, he turned that around on its head and said, well, I won't make inexperience and age an issue in this campaign. And instantly defeats him. I mean, this was the spirit of this man that looked grandfatherly, but boy, oh boy, could he think fast on his feet. And maybe that was the appeal here, that all these little idiosyncrasies, the minutiae moves away. And again, America perhaps craving what they had in Eisenhower, somebody, an individual that they could get behind, and who better than a Hollywood superstar, former governor. But this is kind of getting us a little bit off track in a way, but the economic recovery of that period, it was almost impossible not to have some form of recovery after the Carter years. But how then can we compare it to what we're seeing in today's economy and today's very confused American society that you've already explained is divided between big city USA and the suburbs, exurbs, or rural areas? Completely different sentiment.
We also have two economic sides of America. And the irony is the people who have benefited from the most gains in wealth and the most gains in income, many of them are on the political left. So you have a lot of people on the political left, they've done quite well. The real estate holdings have gone up. Their stocks have gone up. They are part of the establishment. The establishment is the political left right now. It's just a matter of how far left you want to go. So that's peculiar, because the left was always supposed to, or at least for a long time, there was this idea that they represented the working man or the common man. And that illusion is nothing more than an illusion now. But the other thing that I need to point out is that our economy was easier to fix in the 70s than it is today. And I'll tell you why. And this is something very unique. This is something that I don't think very, very few people have ever thought about this. So we measure economic growth by something called gross domestic product. The problem is the way a gross domestic product is measured is we count government deficit spending as economic growth, okay? Which is not, we've been doing this for a long time. So what that means, if you were to extrapolate that to a household, it'd be like if somebody tells their spouse, I've charged an extra $2,000 a month on that credit card, therefore we have an extra $2,000 of income for that month. So we're counting deficit spending as growth. If we were to remove deficit spending from the calculation of economic growth, in the last 20 odd years, very few of those years would we have had any economic growth in the United States. And that's the scary part. So all these years where we're posting some kind of economic growth, it is a house of cards built on deficit spending.
That is an incredible revelation, because what we're exposing in real time is a dysfunctional economy and a complete lack of increase in productivity. I mean, this is entirely what any economy is all about. I mean, you only get growth when you improve productivity and become more efficient. That's the purpose of what's going on. And so here it's entirely disguised by permanent deficit spending. It's astonishing. Is this a change in recent time? Is this something that's been going on as far back as we can remember? How does this equate, and how does America seemingly have this bottomless pit of $34 trillion there that can just keep expanding?
It's a financial cancer that has grown for a long time. What has allowed it is the prominence of the U.S. dollar, the fact the U.S. dollar is traded all over the world. And so having that huge demand for the dollar helps to perpetuate the value of the dollar. There's so many other currencies out there that people don't rely on and trust. We do have the advantage that the U.S. government has never defaulted on their payments. We have the longest credit history of any country in the world. And in terms of just the long, and so a lot of people look at the dollar as very strong. They prefer to do business. They prefer to do international trade in dollars. So that's part of it. But the other part of it is we've moved from an industrial to service-based economy. And it's very easy to calculate productivity in industry because it's very quantitative. How many tires are we making an hour? How many Jeeps are we making per month? We can count manufactured goods. That was very efficient, a very efficient way. But with services, you're counting stuff like customer satisfaction. And there's a lot of qualitative elements to it. And I would argue a lot of people are vastly overpaid because we don't really know how productive they really are working in different service positions. And of course, some people could be vastly underpaid. It's a, I used to do some consulting in the hospitality industry, and I would used to laugh about when you go to one restaurant versus another, you know, one restaurant's better, but you don't think in terms of this restaurant is 11% better than the other restaurant. Mm. You know that one is better, but to put a number on it is really, really difficult. And that's part of the problem we have in measuring our economy today. We try to use old-fashioned methods, and we apply them to a lot of people going to work. And are they really producing stuff at work? And is it really worth what they're producing? Are they really getting paid? So we have this problem with artificial demand, which means you have more money chasing after fewer goods. And that is one of the major driving factors of inflation right now in the United States. That was not the case in the 70s. In the 70s, we were having energy prices, and that was more driven by what we'd call natural inflation in the sense that oil wasn't as available, in part because of the oil embargoes that were happening. Literally, we didn't have the quantity of oil coming in, so prices were going up. Right now, you're getting people who are receiving money for nothing. In some cases, you'd mentioned in some countries where immigrants aren't working and receiving money, that's money for nothing. But I would also argue that a lot of jobs in America, we have people getting paid and their salary may be $150,000 a year, but are they really producing $150,000 worth of real goods and services? And I would argue some of those people really aren't. When Elon Musk bought Twitter, he famously fired 80%, I believe, of the workforce, and Twitter continued. I mean, what were those other 80% of the workers doing? And they were making fantastic money. So that's just part of the problem.
It's an interesting one, isn't it, when you have a business like Twitter that in the social media space, technically unlimited income streams in terms of advertising revenue. And so you can cover up many sins in that particular approach. It only works to a point, though, like we're seeing on Meta with the amount of censorship, et cetera. I assume that they're able to keep selling ads. But in the political campaigns, many people were reporting that they couldn't even spend their advertising budget on social media. They were being throttled almost as if that they had too much money. And, of course, in that situation, too many fact checkers, too many other people censoring what's going on and roadblocking. And, of course, when you cut that weight out, perfect example of how this wasn't really providing any productivity. It was supporting an ideology, if you will, a completely separate notion. And that's kind of where we are today. Now, I'm just noticing that it's just being reported today that economic aides to former President Trump are looking for options to stop countries from shifting away from the US dollar as it faces a growing challenge from emerging markets. Now, this is interesting. They're saying that options could include penalties on including export controls, currency manipulation charges, tariffs. And that's interesting. How do you think that works in terms of Trump? Is he getting onto the front foot or is he getting onto the back foot, if you will, in terms of realizing that he needs to have a strong greenback to maintain US's place as a strong place in the world economically?
I would like to believe he's telling people this because this sounds like something that would be a quick fix. The American people love quick fixes. We're very impatient. We don't focus on things very long. That's a good and a bad thing. We're very good at adapting to new things, not so good at learning from our mistakes. The real root of the problem is our budget. If we don't get our budget under control, no matter what we do, it's not going to help the value of the US dollar. if you try to impose these kinds of, these are called capital controls, what you talked about, what inevitably happens is people go around them. They'll use cryptocurrencies, they'll use black market or gray market or alternative market. I would say that clamping down on capital controls will have the opposite effect, maybe not immediately, but if you give people time, they're going to find ways around it. And it also makes people suspicious. You know, why is the American government so determined to force things a certain way? So I would like to believe that the situation can be resolved by using more market-based means and by being more fiscally responsible. But getting Congress to act that way, that's going to be a problem, regardless of who's running Congress.
No, absolutely. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time on today's discussion. It's flown by. Josiah Baker, I want to thank you again for coming onto the show and your wonderful analysis. If you don't mind, just quickly to hold up the books. One is called The Optimist. This is a self-help book that will change your life, that is for sure. And the other book is called Religion, Politics, The Polarization. There it is right there. So please check out those two books. We have to go, and we're going to come back after the break with a brand new guest for you. James Allen will be joining me after the break. Thank you, Josiah, for a terrific summary of what's going on, a perspective that you only get here. Thanks for watching and listening. Don't go anywhere. This is the one and only TNT.